Hello, this is Tim Lightfoot, your host. And before we get to the podcast, I know that many of you know that today the London Olympics begin. And many of us are excited about that for the stories that will be happening there. But you may not know that we're in the midst of a four-podcast series here at the Huffines Institute dedicated to the Olympics. 2 weeks ago, we talked to Sports Illustrated's David Epstein about the stories that he would be reporting on. Today, we have a wonderful podcast from another sports journalist named Christy Ashwanden, and I won't do any more introduction on that because the podcast will be starting here in just a moment. Next week's podcast, and we're going to break the mold here, and we're going to actually announce who we're going to have on the podcast next week. We have Dr. Ed Coyle from the University of Texas, who's done a lot of work with Olympians in the past, and especially their power outputs, and I'd encourage you to listen to that. And then in a week and a half, we've got a special podcast feature that we're going to put up actually a few days early before the end of the Olympics to coincide with a particular event that is happening at the end of the Olympics. And so I hope you tune back in and you download that special edition. Until then, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'd like to welcome you and thank you for taking the time to download us. We have another incredibly interesting individual from the world of sports medicine with us today. We have Ms. Christy Ashwanden with us. Welcome to the podcast, Christy.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, we're so glad that you took time to be with us. I will tell the audience a little bit about you. Christy is a contributing editor for Runner's World. She's been a contributing editor for Health. She is a contributing writer for Skiing, and she has had articles and essays in almost every major publication that you can think of, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, Oprah Magazine, Men's Journal, Slate, NPR, Mother Jones, National Wildlife, Backpacker, Reader's Digest, Self, WebMD, Science, Cell, and News Scientist. She's written and edited books for the World Health Organization, for the National Institutes of Health, and some of her work has actually been highlighted on BBC as well. She was a National Magazine Award finalist in 2011. And was a Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting Fellow in 2007. And I think you've recently put out a book, a coffee table book called Beautiful Chickens, that was about chicken breeds. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. My spare time, I actually live on a little farm in western Colorado where I raise heritage poultry. Mm. My husband is a winemaker, and so we have a little vineyard. But, yeah, so I've developed an interest in chickens and got asked to write a book about them, and it's a really fun project.
Cool. Well, you know, and I'm so glad that you and I reconnected. Christy and I had talked in years past about some of the work that we do in our lab, and one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike Massett, actually pointed me to a recent article of yours in Smithsonian Magazine, and that allowed us to start talking again. And Christy's written extensively about sports medicine and sports, and we're just going to have a nice conversation here about that and what some things that you think are coming in the London Olympics in particular. But let's start off with tell us your story. How'd you become a freelance journalist? You were on the path to be a scientist at one point.
I sure was. I have a degree in biology, and I always thought that I would be a scientist. I started off, I remember in high school, I wanted to be a doctor, and then I participated in this high school program where I got to follow some doctors around, kind of shadow them, and I realized that being a doctor meant hanging out with sick people all day, and I didn't really want to do that.
That kind of killed that, huh?
Yeah, it did, and that sounds so unkind, but I really, you know, I wanted to be outside doing interesting things with science, and so I got a degree in biology. As an undergraduate, I did field research, working at the Mountain Research Station outside of Boulder. Really loved that. After college, I did several different research jobs. My problem was that I was really interested in science, but a lot of different types of science. And when you go into a PhD program, which is what I had planned to do, you have to specialize. And I just couldn't find it in myself to limit myself to one topic. And so I kept bouncing around from one research job to another, trying out different things, trying to decide what I wanted to do my PhD on. Never did find a way to just pick one thing. That's one thing I really like about freelancing, actually, is that I get to write about a lot of, you know, a very wide range of topics. And so at one of my research jobs, I was working at a biotech company, and I was a little bit bored of my job, and I started writing a column for the company newsletter. Mm. And the guy who wrote it said, "Wow, you know, you're a really good writer. Have you ever considered science writing?" Mm. And I said, "Huh, what's that?" You know, I didn't even realize that there was this sort of career opportunity. So that's kind of how it started. I ended up looking into sort of the career field there, and I went to a very special program at University of California, Santa Cruz, that kind of specializes in making scientists into writers.
Mm,
so I went there. It's a one-year graduate program, and that's kind of the rest is history. I started freelancing right out of school, in fact, during that year at Santa Cruz, and never looked back.
Cool. And, you know, and science journalists play such an important role nowadays. I mean, one of the things that we often talk about is who translates the science that's done in the lab to the public. And that's role that science journalists play.
That's right. And it's kind of interesting. I find that sometimes as a journalist, I play a role in helping scientists learn about other research that they're doing and kind of connecting scientists and putting sometimes... You know, we're taking sort of we stand back a little bit and take a bigger view, and sometimes we can see things or make connections and help people from different fields of science see what's out there and find new connections.
Well, as scientists, we're often so stuck in our own forest and looking at our own trees that we can't take that 30,000-foot view that scientific journalists have.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So much of your writing deals with sports and sports medicine in particular. How did you develop, or where does that passion come from for sports medicine?
Well, I've been an athlete since I was 13. I joined the cross country team in high school, became state champion before high school was out, and then I was a runner at University of Colorado on the cross country team there. During that time, I got injured, so I quit running and started bicycling. Started bike racing. I also started ski racing. After college, I competed at an elite level. First at bicycle racing, but then cross-country skiing is a sport that I pursued at a high level for many years. In fact, I lived and raced in Europe for several years. And so, you know, it's my background as an athlete that gave me this natural interest. So it's just something that I've always been interested in.
Yeah, and I noticed in one of your recent articles that we're going to talk about, actually, in Smithsonian, you talk about that one of the riders in the Tour de France for several years, Tyler Hamilton, was a teammate of yours at Colorado.
Yeah, that's right. He was. I got to know Tyler when I was on the CU cycling team. We all thought he was just the greatest guy. He was really friendly. You know, he was never a super close friend, but he was a good acquaintance and someone, you know, our team was really tight-knit. We traveled together. In fact, that year we won nationals. It was held at Harvard, I believe it was in Cambridge. Mm. And afterwards, his parents threw us this great party to celebrate. So we were all, I mean, I was just so disheartened when he was caught doping. And of course, he spent many, many years denying that he had doped. And just recently, after he was subpoenaed in the Lance Armstrong case, finally came out on 60 Minutes. You know, he's never spoken to me about it. I tried for the Smithsonian article to interview him. He wouldn't respond to any of my phone calls, emails, et cetera. And in fact, it turns out that some of our mutual friends who really had considered him a close friend haven't heard anything from him since his confession, including one friend who had spent quite a bit of time donating his time and working with his foundation, never got a personal apology. So it was pretty sad.
Well, it's really shocking. And that's really almost the underlying topic of your article in the Smithsonian. And by the way, for our listeners, any of the articles that we mentioned today, I'll make sure I put links to those articles in the show notes so you can go and read those. And I would really encourage you to do that because Christy is a fabulous writer and has wonderful perspective on this. But that was, you started that article off in the Smithsonian with the story of D.D. Trotter, who was upset that someone thought that perceived that all of athletes were dirty. As a matter of fact, she started a foundation called Test Me, I'm Clean. Do you really think that there is that prevalent notion that all athletes, especially endurance athletes, are doping out there?
Well, I mean, I think it's a symptom of, you know, if someone like Tyler Hamilton, which, you know, it's not just me and my, you know, these buddies of mine that knew him in college. I mean, he really had this reputation as being, you know, the guy next door, the really honest person. And if someone like that was doping, it just shows how prevalent it is. And it's prevalent in the culture. And I think this is what the USADA case that they've brought against Lance Armstrong is all about. I mean, they're really out to change this culture. And so I think that there are a lot of fans that think that. As a journalist, you know, I have to be skeptical. I mean, that's my job.
Right.
But I think having been burned by Tyler, having seen, I mean, all of these things, you know, Marion Jones, you know, said she was the most tested athlete in history. She denied. She, you know, tried to, you know, get Congress, et cetera, to investigate USADA. Well, she eventually confessed. So it's sort of like, you know, a lot of times people think that, well, the victims of someone like Tyler Hamilton or Marion Jones are the people, you know, that were in second or third place in those races that they won. But that's not the extent of it. I mean, it's every other athlete who is now, you know, every good performance is now under suspicion. And that's just, we need to eliminate that. It's just not fair to the clean athletes.
Yeah, because to some extent, it doesn't matter if you've tested cleanly or not over the years.
That's right. I mean, the testing has gotten better.
Right.
They're doing the best that they can, but it's not enough, and they know that. I mean, if you talk to David Hammond, the head of WADA, Travis Tigard at USADA, they know the tests aren't enough. I mean, the athletes, the problem is these rogue athletes are so much better funded. And, you know, the thing you have to understand is it's not just the athletes who are benefiting. There's this whole entourage problem.
Right.
For each of these star athletes, there are, you know, dozens perhaps of other people who are making their living off their successes. And so there's so much incentive, and it really does come down to money. So, you know, they're just outclassed. And
right.
With each test, there's a new workaround. They know that. One of the things they do when they do catch athletes, and you know, they have these very frank discussions with them during the sanctioning phase. I mean, they've learned a lot from those discussions, finding out ways now of how the athletes are circumventing the testing. You know, they can make the tests better. They can do things. Tyler Hamilton was caught because they unveiled a new test, you know, sort of in secret. It's their prerogative to do that. They don't have to announce that they have a new test,
right.
But no one knew that they had the test, and that's how they caught him. But, you know, once people know the test is out there, they'll find a way around it.
Now, do you think that with all the renewed interest in Lance Armstrong, his big defense is, I tested cleanly for, I don't know how many tests, 700 tests, 600, whatever his lawyers are saying now, but yet three of his entourage were just banned for life. What's going to happen if it comes out that Lance Armstrong was doping all those years?
Well, I mean, I think it will, you know, there's going to be a lot of fans who are really, really disappointed, that's for sure. But I mean, I think that USADA is really out to change the culture of sport. If the allegations that they're charging Armstrong with are true, and this will all come out as the arbitration goes forward, Lance's Johan Bruneel, his team manager, is choosing to go into arbitration. So this evidence will be made public at one point. Right now, actually, the reason that it's not public is that to protect athletes, actually. So if it goes into arbitration and nothing happens, I mean, there are athletes, this does happen, where they test positive or they have evidence. It goes in, they're not sanctioned, and no one has to know about it.
Right.
That's to protect athletes' reputations, et cetera. So we haven't gotten to that point yet. Now, if someone is high profile as Armstrong, you know, inevitably it comes out. Who knows who's been doing the leaking, right?
Right.
But, you know, this evidence will come out. But I think really the point here is that, you know, if the allegations that USADA has brought forward are true, they're basically describing a culture in cycling where doping was sort of the price of entry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the thing that this could change, if Armstrong is sanctioned, it could say, look, we're not going to tolerate this. The other victims that don't really get heard, the victims of doping, are the athletes who left the sport and left the sport early, were never able to fulfill their potential because they chose not to dope.
Right.
you know, from the looks of it, you don't ride the Tour de France unless you're willing to go on the program. You know, I know personally of cases, you know, where people sort of face that choice. And, you know, it could end up actually changing sport a lot for the better.
Right.
Have a black eye in the short term, but it's really, you know, for the next generations coming up, it could make a profound difference for them.
Well, and you make a great point, and this is one that I heard another writer talk about, and I can't remember who it was, but who talked about, especially the baseball doping era back in the late 90s, early 2000s, he said he felt the worst for those players who didn't dope, who were performing probably at their maximal, but because these other people were doping, these other guys, the clean ones, didn't have a chance to make it to the major leagues or play in the major leagues. He said those are the real victims of this.
That's right. And no one knows their names. You know,
right.
They don't, you know, they're unheralded. They leave the sport. They go do something else.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious that cycling still has an issue. I mean, I think at the time of this recording, they've had two riders already in the Tour de France that have tested positive. One yesterday, Frankie Schleck, I think, tested positive for a diuretic and was dropped from the Tour.
That's
so
right, yeah.
It's certainly still an issue in cycling.
It is, and there's a sense, you know, that it's getting better. I don't know how true that is. I hope that it's true. I mean, I think that we're seeing some evidence that it's true. When you look at the times have been getting slower, et cetera. I mean, I think there is evidence that it's at least getting better. I don't think we can say that we've completely eliminated it yet, but it's going to take time. And it really, like, this is really about the culture of sport, and this is a culture war that's going on. It really isn't about the testing or about that sort of thing. It's really about the culture of sport and what the athletes themselves are going to tolerate.
Yeah.
What they're going to, you know, allow to happen in their sport. It's really going to be up to the athletes to decide whether.
Well, you know, but let me ask you, Christy, I'm sorry to interrupt there. Is this something we should be concerned about? To some extent, is this a false pursuit? In your Smithsonian article, you write very clearly about doping in sport is a relatively recent concern, even though there is evidence that I think you even say something like back in 1904, athletes were using mixtures of cocaine, heroin, and strychnine. All of a sudden now we're very interested in doping and it hasn't been an issue in the past?
Yeah, you're right. It's not that it hasn't been an issue. I mean, so basically the change that's happened is that we've said we don't want people doing that. You know, there was a time, and I think in cycling, it was still quite recently, when doping was really not considered cheating. It was considered cheating in the same way that, you know, speeding down the highway is considered, you know, unlawful among most citizens. It's sort of wink, wink, like the thing that's wrong is to get caught, right? And it's not considered a major crime. Everyone does it, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what's changed. And the other thing that's changed, you know, the testing actually began as a way to protect riders' health. You know, people were getting hurt by doping. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted, you know, that's not good for anyone. It's not good for sport. And, you know, no sport official wants their athletes dropping dead from performance enhancers. So that's really how it started. And then somewhere along the way, it became sort of a moral issue as well. But I think those sort of moral questions about it are fairly recent. And that's a kind of, you know, change in attitude that I think we're seeing going on right now.
Yeah. To some extent, it's a really almost gray area because now you have so many of the athletes that are pushing the frontier for nutraceuticals where you have specific nutrients you can take in or altitude training. I was at a USADA symposium several years ago where they were talking about maybe working on banning carb loading the night before a race, and which just seemed to be the most ridiculous thing in the world. But what it pointed out is that in some people's mind, this is a very fine line between what we would consider illegal doping and what many people now consider the best training techniques.
Yeah, and I think, you know, some of it comes down to, you know, the WADA code. There are some things, you know, what constitutes cheating. You know, one is, does it violate the spirit of sport? You know, there's kind of a fairness thing there,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of the things that WADA looks at is, does it violate the spirit of sport? And I think that there's a fairness aspect to it, because you could say, okay, what's the difference between altitude training and EPO?
Right.
And, and there may be, from a physiological perspective, there probably is a difference, actually, because there are responders and non-responders to altitude. That may be true of EPO, too. I'm not sure. But, you know, as training gets more sophisticated, that's certainly true. And you have to look at, you know, what should sport be measuring? What should sport be showcasing? You know, are we showcasing who has, you know, the best equipment, the most money to travel to exotic places, you know, to train, do altitude training at the top of mountains and things like that? Or are we, you know, providing a showcase for human talent? And that's where things get sticky, though. It really can be hard to draw the line.
Yeah, it's sometimes difficult to tease out the natural talent from all the augmented stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And there's kind of, I mean, there's this idea of a level playing field, which, you know, let's be honest, it doesn't exist. That's why we watch sport, right? I mean, if everyone had the same level of talent, I mean, the biggest non-level playing field comes from just your innate talent. But then after that, there are things like hard work, training, all of that. And I think that's what fans want to see, you know, when they go out there and want to watch athletes, they want to see them pushing themselves.
Yeah. Speaking of pushing themselves, this podcast is going to run right about the time the Olympics begin.
Mm-hmm.
What are you looking forward to in seeing the Olympics? What are the big stories you think that are going to happen?
Well, of course, I am very interested in Oscar Pistorius. So I'm very interested to see what happens with Oscar Pistorius. I think that's going to be a really interesting, you know, it's the first time that a Paralympian will be competing with able-bodied Olympians. So that will be interesting. I'm still a runner at heart, so I love to watch the track and field events. I'm a distance runner. Always love to see the marathon. One thing that makes the marathon so great is that you just never know what's going to happen on race day. I think more so than many other events, there's just so many things that can happen. So I'll look forward to that event.
It's a pretty safe bet, though, to bet on the Kenyans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then I'm really curious to see Missy Franklin, who's a teenager from Denver, rising star in the swimming world. I'd love to see her win some medals, take some medals home. And then, of course, as well, cycling. And in particular, I'd love to see Taylor Finney bring home some medal. He's from Boulder. His parents are both Olympians, and I think he really represents the new generation. I'd like to think that this is the generation that's going to be clean in sport and change the culture. So I'll be looking forward to all of those things.
Yeah, those are going to be fun stories. And we've talked about Oscar Pistorius. We've had several guests on over the years that have been part of the teams that have analyzed his running. And that's an interesting conversation, because he may have a mechanical advantage that others don't have, which is always an interesting discussion.
Yeah, and I mean, that goes back to, you know, do we just file that under, well, you know, we all are born with different genes?
Yeah.
Or, you know, what point do you draw the line there? I think some of those issues are raised with the gender stuff as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, with Castor, yeah.
With Castor, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the supplements to your Smithsonian article was where you talked about the future of cheating. You talked about gene doping in sport. How soon do you think that's going to happen? And do you think that's going to be an even bigger anti-doping challenge than the current challenges with steroids and growth hormone?
Well, that's a great question. As far as I can tell, I think that I was the first journalist to write about this, which was back in 1999. I think that first feature that I wrote about this published in like January 2000 in New Scientist magazine. And I remember at that point I think the story began with this fictional scenario of the Olympics in Athens, you know, and there are going to be all these gene-doped athletes. And that hasn't happened. I mean, we don't have good evidence at this point that anyone has undergone gene doping. There was one guy, Thomas Springsteen, who tried to obtain a gene therapy treatment that was under development. There's no evidence that he ever got it. But it's really, I'm kind of skeptical, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's stuff that's really sci-fi. It sounds neat, but it's extraordinarily dangerous. Mm-hmm. And just from a scientific perspective, I mean, these are therapies that are being developed to treat real diseases. And there have been some success stories, but it hasn't been something that has been very easy to produce. And I think that the risks, this may be something where the risks are just too high. I don't think that it will be widespread until or unless the other testing just gets so good that they're forced to turn to it. And I don't think we've reached that point yet.
Well, it's interesting, your last sentence there really reflects one of our other guests, David Epstein from Sports Illustrated. He has often said that he still thinks doping is prevalent because the testing is still not very good and people aren't caught very often. And it's from your last sentence that almost sounds like that's the perspective you have at this point.
Absolutely, yeah. David's right. And you know, the testers themselves will tell you that.
Yeah.
They're under no illusion, and that's why, you know, these you know, when an athlete insists that I've never tested positive, you know, that's different than saying I've never doped.
Right.
I think that that's very telling.
Right. We've got a few minutes left, and I want to turn to very quickly to another topic, and maybe we'll have you back on, I think, to discuss more of this, because this is fascinating, and certainly these things are almost changing as we speak. But I wanted to point out, you've done some public speaking about your time as a scientific journalist. As a matter of fact, I think you did a talk at a seminar that was titled, "You've Got Mail, You Idiot."
Oh, yeah.
Which I love the title of the talk, but it really talked, that talk was about the things you've learned from the comments that people send you.
Yeah.
Can you share with the audience a little bit kind of the synthesis? I think anytime anybody puts something out in the public, especially nowadays in the society that we're at, we're liable to get all kinds of comments.
Oh, yeah. I get hate mail, and you know, I have to admit, I sort of relish it sometimes. You know, it's kind of fascinating to see when you really hit a nerve. And it's never with the things, you know, it's not the really controversial things that I write about. The story that I've gotten absolutely by orders of magnitude the most hate mail over was this cover story I did for Reader's Digest about supplements. Mm. Vitamin supplements in particular. Basically, it was synthesizing just this whole pile of evidence that's been accumulating for years now, just showing that multivitamins really aren't necessary and don't help most people, et cetera. And I got so much hate mail.
Wow.
And in fact, I'm currently, I'm finishing up today, actually, writing a story for Slate that will be running probably about the time this podcast comes out. I'm writing this piece for Slate about supplement use in sport, and I expect to get a lot of hate mail for that too, because people really think that these things help them. And so the thing that I've learned as a science journalist is that when you write something that tells people that they're wrong about some very deeply held belief, they get really mad.
Mm.
And so if you present them with evidence that contradicts their belief, people will process it through their existing belief system, and if it doesn't fit, they'll just reject the evidence. And this is something everyone does. I mean,
right.
There's no, you can't just say these are crazy readers, because, you know, we all do this. We all have stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves and the world, and we don't like it when the facts contradict that.
Yeah. As a geneticist who has in some places been involved in the evolution discussion in the public, you certainly see that when scientific fact meets someone's frame of reference or their belief system, scientific evidence loses out every time.
Well, that's right, because, you know, for the person who's denying evolution, they're not denying the facts, they're not denying the science, and in fact, most likely, they haven't really examined them. They haven't taken the time to really try to understand them. What they hear is, you're a monkey. And they say, no, I'm not. I'm not a monkey. Don't call me a monkey.
Right.
And, you know, the more you try to explain to them that, well, it's not really a monkey, but blah, 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 you know, nuance, you know, they're still hearing, you're a monkey, you're a monkey, you're a monkey. And at that point, like, the dialogue has shut off, and you can't reconcile that with facts.
Right. Well, it's interesting, though, that it says something about our society, I think, when people are willing to send you hate mail for an article that you've written, as opposed to trying to have a reasonable, healthy, intellectual dialogue.
Yeah, no, it is telling. And, you know, it really, I think that there's something special, too, about the internet now allows people, I mean, people will be really mean and say really nasty stuff that they would probably never say to a person face to face.
Right.
And so it's really, in a way, it's almost made things a lot worse, because if you have to talk to someone face to face, there's just a certain level of civility that most of us want to maintain. And it's also a lot harder, you know, when you're sort of just shouting at someone on the internet, mm-hmm. it's very easy to dehumanize them.
Mm-hmm.
That's harder to do in person.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fascinating. We're running out of time here, though, Christy. Well, like I said, we'll have to have you back on to catch up with what's going on in the sports world, as well as to continue to talk about how do we fix all the internet problems.
and
society's conversation problems. As we always do with our guests, though, we want to give you an opportunity to give us a take-home message. What would your take-home message be?
Well, I think my take-home message is, you know, the Olympics are starting, and I just think the Olympics are one of the most awesome, amazing things in the world. It's an amazing opportunity to showcase human excellence. I love watching all of the different events. I would just say, you know, it's easy to be pessimistic with all the doping scandals and other scandals, and there's so much money in the Olympics now. But I think at the very finest level, you know, those athletes out there are giving it their best. They've spent years and years coming to this moment. So I just want to sit back and enjoy it and give those athletes their due.
It will be a fun 3-week period of time, won't it?
It will be, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for being with us today. I've really enjoyed the conversation today.
Thanks so much for having me. I loved it.
You're welcome. And for all of you that are listening, I want to thank you so much for downloading us and tuning us in this week. Before we leave, we do have our free T-shirt question of the week from Cheryl.
What is the name of the foundation formed by D.D. Trotter in response to the controversy that all athletes are doping?
Excellent question. Be the first one to email us with the answer to that question, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts. I would encourage you to do that, because we're running out of our second edition of T-shirts, as a matter of fact. And if you want one of these, you'll need to respond. So again, thank you all for taking the time to download us and listen. And Christy, thanks for taking the time from your beautiful scenery in Colorado today to be with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, we hope all of you will download us next week when we have another interesting individual in sports medicine. And we hope until then that you stay active and stay healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Samantha Springer and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.